The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Families that go here, grow here.
And we're joined in studio by Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormack. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here today. Which of you would like to give us the potted history of the book, just so we know as the entree? Why don't you give us the knock?
Well, we have been working on the Bad Bridget project for, nearly 10 years now.
Yeah.
Elaine and I had both separately, unbeknownst to each other, been working, looking at Irish women in Boston and New York. And previously we'd worked on Irish women on the island of Ireland. Mm-hmm. And we were really interested to know what was happening to these women when they went to North America. We knew they were committing crimes and getting up to all sorts in Ireland. So what was happening when they went to America? And we got together, we decided there's a bigger project here. And we came up with the Bad Bridget project.
Great. Now we're off. Okay, and what I love about the book and the project is that, as I said just a little bit before the break, history of any hue is written by men, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And we lose sight of these stories. You've reached into the shadows. You've reached into the bottom decks of the boats. You've gone into the murky corners of the prisons all around 19th century New York and Mulberry Street and beyond, and you found them. So how do you go about doing that? And what was your... your raison d'etre for it? What were you hoping to achieve?
Well, we're building on kind of decades of research on Irish women's history, and that has been done before us, and you know, kind of building on what has been done about Ireland. And what we really wanted to do was get into those records.
Yeah.
We knew that the Irish women were there. And so what we ended up doing was trawling through archives and libraries in the US, looking for prison registers, looking at court records, looking at newspapers, and we'd find a little fragment.
Yeah.
So a woman's name, maybe her crime, and we'd have to try to trace her through other records, seeing what we could find. And sometimes it would be a dead end. And some of our women have common names, and we can't say for sure that this is the same woman that we're finding in different records. And then other women, we see just a small reference in a prison register. And when we go looking, we find an amazing story. And we find these historical records that give us a real insight into what their lives were
you're
like.
You're into that. You find the tapestry, you know, you find the thread that becomes
yes,
the
exactly.
piece of material that becomes the whole piece of tapestry. You go, oh, my
yeah.
God, we've now reconstructed a whole life
yeah.
story. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
How fascinating that must be.
It's not just about the crime. It's
yeah.
actually about the domestic life. It's about the motivations for emigration. It's
yeah.
about relationships.
Let's talk about why Irish people, but I'm going to focus on women today because that's really what we're talking about. Why did Irish women and girls, I was struck by that, the youth of them, why yes. were they getting on boats to go to, if in this case, the United States at this time? Most common reason.
Again, often it's poverty, it's economics.
Mm.
So we our sort of starting point was 1838, just before the peak of emigration, really, in the years of the Great Famine and following that.
Yes.
So you see, women and girls were often those who were sent to try and make money and to send money back home. And Ireland's very different in terms of emigration compared to other European countries, where often women would travel as part of a family group. So you'd see it as daughters and wives all going together with men.
Mm-hmm.
And Ireland's very different, where women are travelling on their own and often very young. You know, our youngest that we see was about seven.
Seven, yeah.
So travelling
on her
their,
own?
On their
yeah.
own.
Extraordinary.
You know, and maybe going to having an address or having a contact or somebody to meet when they get there. But so often when they got there, those people had moved. People, you know, moved around very much. There was no kind of, you weren't able to text your address or your change of address. So
yeah.
often, you know, people had moved and they didn't know by the time they got there. So it's generally for those reasons about trying to make money and send money back home. And the idea of chain migration, you know, with women as well was really common about daughters and aunts going out, sending money back home and girls and women coming out again. But that meant that Irish women were often arriving without those support networks. They weren't in a family group. They were on their own. And that made them vulnerable to all sorts of things as well. And the reason why we end up seeing so many of them appearing in registers and arrests as well.
Well, give us a flavour. I remember being in Ellis Island once as a tourist a number of years ago and thinking, imagine landing here, you know, in New York from, as you point out in your book, not the cities of Ireland, from the villages. Like, you've just come from, like, the parish pump, the priest, you know, yeah, the tiny yeah. school and a donkey. And now you're in late 19th century or thereabout mid 19th century New York City with the Tower of Babel of voices and sounds mm-hmm. and smells and cultures. What do you do as a 7 to 25-year-old young woman landing in outer space, essentially?
I mean, it must have been such a sensory shock.
Could you imagine?
Yeah, and even, you know, we have records where the Irish girls and women are talking about the, you know, the climate. They're not used to these hot summers, the really, really cold winters. And that takes its toll. Like, yeah. if these are girls and women who have landed with very little money in their pockets, they need to try to get a job straight away. But who are their contacts? They might know people there, but those people might be so poor they're not actually able to help them in any way. So it must have been a complete shock for them. And when we're looking at these records, we're looking at some child protection agency records, because they're going in looking at what the conditions are that the children are living in. And it's through those records then we're able to see the sheer poverty that these families are living in. Like, we have one woman, Mary Linsky, and she's living in a house with her husband and three sons. And when the child protection agents go in, they realise that the pipes have burst, have completely flooded the house. But because it's winter, the water has frozen. So the stairs are covered in ice. There's no doors in the tenements. They've got no furniture. All they've got, the only furniture they have in the house is a cot, and they've got a bed. They've got one knife and one fork in a family of five, and three dishes, and the clothes that's on their backs. And you just think, like, this is the reality. Like, this is the poverty that these Irish people were living in. And that's probably not what they imagined when they were leaving Ireland.
You know, you reminded me of a tour I did in New York of the Tenement Museum. Have you been to it? I don't know what part of it is, Soho or something. I'm not. It's down
East Side.
East Side. Yeah, you have it in one. And that is so evocative, because thankfully they've kept a building intact, and, you know, the Italians and the Irish were coming in, and you really got a sense of the teeming masses, didn't you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm just thinking about one of our cases, Marion Canning, who lived on Mulberry Street.
Yes, yeah, that's
and
it. That's
yeah, and she, you know, that by the time she was living there, it had become that part of Little Italy. Mm. But you know, they describe about how in the tenement building that she's in, the previous census had recorded there were over 70 people living in that one, you know, that one block, that one tenement house, rather, and that, you know, there was a bar, a saloon in the ground floor. You know, there was probably a brothel as well. You know, so it's all of this sort of noise and voices, and most of those people would have been Italians as well. So you're thinking, here's this girl from, you know, rural Ireland in the middle of all of this. It's all happening in the noise and the streets. And when you see those pictures of somewhere like Mulberry Street as well, you just get the whole feeling of that constant mass of people and languages and all sorts of things as well. So it must have been a shock.
It's like Dickens does New York.
Yeah.
You know, you got that sense of these narrow streets and smoky and impoverished. And the women in your book, or the girls, if you want to call them that, for some of them were surely that, it just seemed to gravitate, rightly or wrongly, or for another, beyond their control, to sex work, domestic servitude, as well as service. I mean, I think there's probably a nuance in that. Prison spells. I mean, this was not the land of milk and honey.
For many of the Irish immigrants, they were what we might term, okay, successful, in that they were earning money through, say, their work in domestic service, or they got factory work. But we're looking at the other side and kind of hoping to show the kind of wider narrative of this Irish emigration story.
Yes. And with that in mind, let's talk about the idea of the name Bridget, because you call it Brad Bridget, but really Bridget is a bit like what Paddy used to be, isn't it? It's the female equivalent of Paddy, the Paddy Irishman.
Yeah, and that was sort of why we chose the name Bridget as well, and because it comes up so often, particularly in North America, the term Bridget or Biddy, and used in that derogatory way, often to apply to all Irish women. So you see people often talking about their servants as Biddy and Bridget, even though that's not their name. Mm. You know, that's just the term that was given. And you see the kind of the images that appear all over North American newspapers of, you know, stupid Biddy. She's ignorant. She's just, you know, come from the bogs, and she doesn't know how to manage in these North American houses. There's one cartoon that always sort of sticks in my mind. It's of, you see the table, family sitting around a table, and and Bridget there in her slip, and she's holding a bowl of tomatoes, and the caption says, "This is not what we meant when we said that we wanted the tomatoes undressed." And, you know, it's that sort of, she doesn't know how to manage in a house. She's an idiot. And for us, it was about sort of reclaiming the name as well, and about saying, hang on, this is about a wider experience, and all of the factors that come into play about what made Bridget end up in the places she ended up.
We're so used to the idea of the Irish as a sort of a simian, you know, subclass from the Punch magazines in the time of the of this kind of similar era. And it's so good that you guys have brought to life or to the light the idea that there is a female equivalent of that, albeit in New York, as just this idiot woman who's no use and a bit thick because she's from Ireland, let's face it. And this isn't it great? It took us a long time to come around to discovering it, but it just sheds a light that's so important, as you know. Let's talk about the jails and the amount of Irish women that spent time in American jails. Tell us about what you found there and why were they there?
I mean, we were completely overwhelmed.
Really?
Yeah. We knew we were going to find Irish women because we had found them in Ireland and we were expecting they're going to be there. But when we looked at these prison registers, you know, in one instance in the 1860s, we have 86% of one single prison is made up of Irish women. They're totally outnumbering every single other nationality, including the native-born American women combined. So it's staggering. So for us, you know, we were hoping we'd go in there and we'd get the names of every single Irish woman who committed a crime. But it was just so incredibly overwhelming seeing all those figures. And I suppose for us then, we're trying to piece together the stories of these names that we're seeing, or trying to see what the background is to all of these figures.
Did you get a kind of common thread as to why they were there, or was it totally case by case, disparate reasons?
For a lot of these women, they're in for crime, for drunkenness or crimes related to drunkenness, and they're in for petty theft.
Yeah.
And we have then women at other extremes who are in for, you know, we've got kidnapping, we've got manslaughter, we've got murder in there as well. So there's a wide variety of crime, but the vast majority are in for drunkenness. And it kind of seems to be a stereotype that's nearly self-perpetuating.
The drunken Irish. Here
we go
again.
If a woman, exactly. And she appears in court and she's been charged with drunkenness. And because of the stereotype of the Irish drinking, the assumption is, oh, she must be guilty. And if she has a criminal record already, next time she comes into court, they'll just send her down again.
There she goes again. I mean, we had the author Thomas Keneally in yesterday talking about Schindler's Ark or Schindler's List. But he also talked about the Irish emigrant experience and going to Australia and what have you. And he linked the famine with our drink problem in the sense that sense of national trauma and the desire to seek oblivion through alcohol. And I suspect when you think of the era we're talking about, that's next door to the famine. And a lot of these women and girls may have seen things and been in positions that they couldn't forget and desperately wanted to, and found it oblivion at the end of a bottle. I mean, there's something in that too, I suspect.
Yeah, absolutely. And even some of the, when they're coming into the prisons, they will say the reason why they turned towards drink, and it'll be the death of a child, it'll be the breakdown of a relationship. But we also have women who nearly play up the stereotype of the drunken Irish.
Okay.
We have one woman from Toronto, Eleanor David, and she talks about how, you know, she's drunkenly singing in front of a concert hall, and it takes four policemen to drag her away, take her to prison.
Yeah.
And when she comes before the courts, then she says, you know, as long as there's a drop of Irish blood in my body, I am going to drink and I'm not going to stop until the sods of the valley cover me. You know, she's really playing up that idea of the drunken Irish in court.
You also make a point about how some people, such was the level of poverty that prison, a stint in prison, food, water, warmth, albeit rank and probably filthy, was preferable to the tenements you described a little earlier on as well.
Yeah, and we do see that particularly for some of the older women as well. And a lot of these women who are in for drink-related offences are what they call rounders. So they're literally going round and round. They're coming into prison. They've been arrested. They're going to court. They've been sent down. They're in prison for a few days. They're out again. And then they're back round in the system again. And you see, we have a couple of examples, I think, again, from Toronto, where they're all in a big group and they're all kind of they've all been arrested together, and you know, one of them saying it's pea and ham soup for lunch today, and you know, they're all kind of going down, and some of them, you know, they're smiling at the judge, they're saying thank you, because they're often homeless, yeah. And this is actually somewhere where you will get fed. Yeah. It's not great conditions, but you'll get fed. You've got a roof over your head, and actually, it's probably preferable, particularly during the winter, and whenever all of these cities are really, really cold in the winter time. So it's. You know, it's a better place.
Yeah, and who knows how many of them had experienced the workhouse and what that might have done to their psyche in terms of poverty, and what constitutes warmth for one person. You know, in comparative terms, a prison is the lap of luxury after a workhouse or nothing else. Let me ask you about Annie Young. Who'd like to take the lead on Annie? Yes,
I love Annie Young.
Tell me all about that. Tell us all about Annie Young.
Yeah, so Annie Young is from Sligo, and I'm from Sligo.
Well,
so
immediately
the case jumped out to me. What I like about Annie Young's case is, so in 1901 and 1911, she pops up in the Irish census. So there she is living at home in Sligo with her father. So if we were looking at the Irish records, that's what we would see. That's her life. But the reality is there's a case file on her in Boston showing what her life was like in those intervening 10 years. So she migrated. She got married. She had a son who died in infancy. She had a daughter. And she's arrested for keeping a disorderly house, as it would have been termed. She's put into prison, and she doesn't have enough money to pay the fine, and so a neighbour is looking after her daughter while she's in prison, and so that triggers the involvement of the child protection agents, and that their involvement goes on for years and eventually results in her daughter being taken away from her toddler daughter being taken away from her. Why I also like this case is we have a letter from Annie Young herself in the files, and it can be very hard to find those type of records. So this case actually gives us such an insight into what domestic life was like.
It might as well be watching her on YouTube. I mean, this is history gold.
Exactly. Yeah. And she serves time in prison, and then she returns to Ireland in 1910. And so she's writing the letter back saying she'd like to get to know her child. And before she had sailed on the ship back home, she had tried to get her daughter back. And they wouldn't allow her. And so the child is adopted then in America. And years later, the child, who has now grown up, puts a notice in one of the papers in Boston trying to trace her mother. Yeah, so it's one of, we have many cases that have happy endings, and then there's others that have kind of heartbreaking
stories. We're not even touching on the crime and the sin of babies being taken out of Ireland and sold off to rich families in America. That's another day's work. And Leanna, you're nodding as if to say, have you read any of my theses? but it is. But it's so desperately sad. But we'll stick with where we are today with Bad Bridget, your wonderful book. Yes.
You're right. It is this really sad. And we also, what we found through the research is these survival strategies of parents leaving their children in Ireland and migrating themselves. And imagine the heartbreak of...
Or the parents jumped ship.
Mm-hmm. The parents left, and the children, as you know, babies are being left behind because this is a survival strategy. Yeah. They're hoping, presumably, to, you know, get work in America, get a house settled, and then send for the children
Chain
to come and join
like
them. Exactly. But it might be 10 years later by the time the children join, and they've missed out on their childhood.
Or they won't. They're different people coming over. You know, as you describe this whole process, you can't help but think of, you know, our own story with new immigrants and immigration and what's happening in the conversation, the country. I've often thought we have some class of historical moral obligation to say, look, we reached out, to use that expression, to so many countries, and maybe it's our turn to, now that we have a few bob in our pockets, so-called, to do the same back. But you think of then in the UK and the border. I still remember seeing a ticker there the other day saying hundreds of thousands of children around the world are wandering camps and places alone, much like the 7-year-old on the boat going over. You know, their story is you know, history echoes with these stories, doesn't it? Let's talk about Lizzie Halliday. There's a piece of work. I don't know who wanted. Leanne, is this your? Let's bring Lizzie into the studio now in a certain way. Yeah, go on.
Lizzie's one of those women where, as we said, sometimes we can't find anybody, and it's just a name, and it's a very common name. We don't know anything about them. And Lizzie Halliday, we came across her in a prison register, and it said murder, and we thought, okay, we'll see if we can find anything about her. And suddenly, you know, she has her own Wikipedia page. She's there, you know, and her sort of, she's her infamy is related to that she was the first woman in New York to be sentenced to death by the electric chair. She ends up not being electrocuted in the end. She's sent to what was then an asylum for the rest of her days. But Lizzie, and again, when she dies, the New York Times term her the worst woman in the world because she had been sent to prison originally for murdering her husband and two neighbours. And the thing that really, I think, that captured people were so interested in Lizzie's story was that there didn't seem to be any motive for this murder. It wasn't about... She didn't gain anything by killing him. It wasn't about
wealth,
money. It
yes,
wasn't about
yeah.
jealousy. There was sort of the normal reasons why people might be
sure.
pushed to murder weren't there for Lizzie Halliday. And then there was more and more investigation into her background. And at one point they even sort of say, you know, she might have been in London at the same time as Jack the Ripper. Is she Jack the Ripper?
And she might as well.
She's sort of saying, you know, don't be daft. This is not, you know, and that she'd maybe had a husband in Belfast and she'd killed him as well. And of course, you know, she migrated as a child and all sorts of things. And in her past, she seems to have had married a number of elderly men who seemed to die quite quickly after after she'd married them. So there were sort of suspicions about what she'd been doing. But her behaviour in court was... The newspapers, you know, reported on this all the time and often that, you know, she was like a tigress and a wolf woman and how she looked and what her facial features were doing as well and were really reported on. But it's quite clear that Lizzie Halliday, you know, was mentally ill. There were clearly, you know, sort of that she had sort of really serious issues. And when she goes to the mental asylum, actually, she ends up murdering again an attendant there who she'd become very attached to and who was going to leave. And for Lizzie, that couldn't happen. She couldn't have her leave her.
Lizzie Halliday. Do we know what part of the country she hailed from?
Well, Elaine likes to suggest that she's from County Antrim, which is where I live. But
I wonder if she's from Sligo originally.
I think she may have been.
All right. I just want to quickly mention Laura Wilson. Because she was known as the chameleon thief. And how can you not want to know more about the chameleon thief, Laura Wilson? Why don't you, Elaine?
So she had this whole strategy of breaking into houses, but she doesn't seem to, there doesn't seem to have been any financial need for this. So what she would do, she'd break into the houses, she'd try on clothes, and she would leave the houses wearing the stolen clothes and leave her own behind. And she loved, they would always know when she had broken into a house when it was her, because she left behind her rum, which she loved to drink, and the smell of cigarettes, because she loved to smoke.
So that was her signature to the
crime. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. And they refer to her as having hair like a woman professor, which we're always slightly amused by.
I ask the both of you as academics to clarify this follicle conundrum.
Yeah, who knows? But we find it so amusing to think of that.
A text says women from poorer countries are in Ireland now as carers and they leave their children behind and they send money home, says Frank. Mm-hmm. Very good point that this is cyclical in history. Terms. Congratulations, as Cormac, to Leanne and Elaine. I saw them in conversation with Katrina Crowe at the Drumineer in Nina Literary Festival in 2021, and they said they were working on a book, and obviously here it is. Looking forward to it. Declan said, just ordered it online. Well, it sounds fascinating. Can't wait to. Well, be sure to, if you're in position, to go to your local bookshop first and then worry about online. How about that?
Yes.
But very good that you're buying it. I'm late for work listening to this. Thank you. This is a great sign, by the way, if people are late for work. Although a long time ago, history is currently repeating itself. We should be kinder and welcoming as a nation to those seeking refuge from abroad, be it fleeing terror or poverty. Well, I just loved it. I think it's one of those books that I've just found myself getting more and more back into nonfiction recently, and especially books like this where you also included some photographs, which I thought was a nice touch because it's just the right period of history that you can get photographs of New York and what have you. So really lovely piece of work. So congratulations to you both on that.
Thank you.
This is a book that will enrich any bookshelf around the country. So get busy getting that. It's called Bad Bridget, and great cover too, if I may say so. Crime, Mayhem and the Lives of Irish Emigrant Women, written by our guests this morning, Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormack. Lovely to meet you both. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
All right, it's 9 minutes to 10.